Chapter 11. A Digital Universe. 1994 through 1999. George Lucas began the morning of Tuesday, November 1st, 1994, as he did most weekday mornings, coming downstairs to the kitchen of his house in San Anselmo, still called Park House or Parkway by those who remembered, to have breakfast with his children. He was exhausted. He'd been up all night tending to 13-year-old Amanda, who was nursing a cold, and the morning had come too soon. Still, being a father would always be Lucas's proudest achievement. In 2015, he would note that he wanted his epitaph to read, "I was a great dad." Spending the mornings with the kids just before school was one of his favorite parts of the day, a time when he could be at his silliest. Whether he was throwing one of them over his shoulder or arguing playfully about the day's schedule. After breakfast, he drove Amanda and 6-year-old Katie to school, just as he always did. Only today, instead of continuing out to the ranch, Lucas returned home to Park House, climbed the stairs to his office, sat down at his desk, and prepared to start writing the script for the next Star Wars film. Lucas knew this was a big deal. Before he had even written a word, he took a moment to be interviewed on camera, looking confident and remarkably unfazed by the task he had before him. "I'm all set," he told his off-camera interviewer as he sank into his chair. "Now all I need is an idea." Even though Lucas was now 50 years old, his preferred attire had changed little in the past 3 decades. Today's outfit consisted of jeans, tennis shoes, and a blue and green plaid shirt, open at the collar. His beard had gone mostly white. His hair, Lucas had always been blessed with good hair, was swept back and up into a towering salt-and-pepper pompadour. The voice was still reedy, but there was new fire in his eyes as he chatted casually with the interviewer about his writing process. It takes a great deal of concentration, and his hopes that the digital technology at his disposal would finally allow him to bring any world he might summon on the page directly to the screen. "I didn't want to go back and write one of these movies unless I had the technology available to really tell the kind of story I was interested in telling," he explained later. "I wanted to be able to explore the world I'd created to its fullest, so I waited until I had the technological means to do that." But technology wasn't going to make the actual writing any easier. In that department, Lucas remained almost defiantly analog, writing his treatment out in longhand on lined notebook paper, just as he had back in 1972. As he sat down at his desk that November, his plan was to write all 3 movies at once, an ambitious goal, particularly for someone who agonized over writing as much as Lucas did. But he promised there was a method in this particular brand of madness. "I'll take a year to write them, a year to prepare them, and a year to shoot them," he explained. "And I'll shoot them all at once." The one thing he wasn't planning to do, however, was direct them, suggesting only that he would decide after he got the films prepared. But there was, he thought, little chance of his being in the director's chair, as miserable as writing made him. Directing was the one part of the filmmaking process he dreaded the most, now largely because it required him to be away from his children for long stretches at a time. Coppola had always affectionately referred to Lucas as a single mother, but it was a label Lucas wore with pride. "There's no one I admire more than single mothers," he told the New York Times, "because they are the real heroes." Indeed, the policies Lucas had put in place in his company were family-friendly enough that Working Mother magazine had named Lucas a family champion in 1994. A designation given to CEOs who oversaw a workplace supportive of the needs of working parents. The same magazine had listed Lucasfilm among the best companies for working mothers, citing the ranch's 2 childcare centers, flexible work schedules, and progressive policies that provided paid leave for employees to attend to sick family members, as well as insurance coverage for domestic partners and their dependents. "We've discovered that quality of life is a much greater asset in securing people than high salaries," said Lucas. "We're just doing what one should be doing." He also pointed out that he, too, was a single parent of 3. "I guess I qualify as a working mother," he added, to Coppola's likely delight. "It's through me that the organization hopefully tries to take a more compassionate view of its employees and what we do," Lucas told Time magazine on another occasion. I rule at the will of the people who work for me. He didn't, however, rule alongside Doug Norby, who had unceremoniously resigned as Lucasfilm's president and CEO in 1992 to return to the board of directors. At that time, Lucas had issued a tight-lipped statement wishing Norby well, then quietly promoted his vice president for business affairs, Gordon Radley, to the post of president and chief operating officer, a position he would hold for nearly a decade, largely owing to his ability to stay out of Lucas's way. The shakeup had raised eyebrows on Wall Street, with some analysts wondering aloud whether Lucas intended to take his company public. But Lucas, as the company's sole stockholder, had no intention of giving up that kind of control. Lucas's form of benevolent dictatorship was obviously working. Morale was generally up and turnover was low. I find myself with this little country, Lucas observed. It's got about 2,000 citizens, and they are very complex. Some are very loyal, and some of them are very dissatisfied. You have to try to make things work. And it's not that easy, but you try to keep people from being used and abused and listen to their grievance and try to do what is fair. Consequently, Lucasfilm employees could choose from a wide range of services and benefits, especially at Skywalker Ranch, where they could enjoy three restaurants and enroll in a variety of classes, including yoga, ballet, and Tai Chi. And Lucas was still working to both expand and consolidate his empire. Over the past few years, he had continued to acquire land adjacent to the ranch, and was still doing so in his accountant's name, eventually increasing Skywalker to nearly 5,000 acres. While Lucas would finally win approval to build three new administrative office buildings on the nearby Big Rock Ranch, ILM would remain stranded in the warehouses in San Rafael, a casualty of continued pushback by Marin County residents, who refused to be swayed by Lucas's promises of new jobs and protected open space. Even as Lucas grumbled about its absence from Skywalker Ranch, ILM continued on its streak of Oscar-winning visual effects. After the razzle-dazzle of Jurassic Park in 1993, ILM had awed audiences the next year with more subtle and even more convincing effects for Robert Zemeckis' Forrest Gump, superimposing actor Tom Hanks into historical footage of President Kennedy, creating crowds at a rally in Washington, D.C., and digitally compositing the feather that floated over the opening credits. With ILM in his corner, Lucas was regarded as the sage of digital filmmaking, with everyone else trying to catch up. Steven Spielberg, now with an Oscar to his name following the success of Schindler's List, looked on with admiration. ILM has no peer, and there is no one even close, said Spielberg, who had just founded his own DreamWorks production company in partnership with music magnate David Geffen and former Disney executive Jeffrey Katzenberg. Journalists sniffing for a story about strife between Lucas and Spielberg suggested that DreamWorks might eventually eclipse Lucasfilm in the realm of digital effects. But Lucas shrugged it all off as nonsense. I want to see Steven succeed. I don't think him succeeding is going to hurt me, he told the Los Angeles Times, adding, We have an agreement not to overtly hurt each other. Still, the larger and more successful Lucasfilm became, the more Lucas raged and railed against the Hollywood machine. Even as the head of a billion-dollar company, Lucas still saw himself as the misunderstood little guy. His company, he insisted, was just a little mud hut outside the castle. The studio system was dead, he proclaimed. It died when the corporations took over. The studio heads suddenly became agents and lawyers and accountants, people who were more interested in stock options than making good movies. Like Luke Skywalker and the rebels defying the odds to beat the Empire, he was the leader of a small group of revolutionaries who had squared off against the faceless, soulless Hollywood machine. They see us as outcasts, as those wacky guys up there who cause trouble because we want creative freedom, Lucas told the New York Times. Up here, we don't have stockholders or dividends. Everything I make goes back into making something else. If we make a mistake, we die. Ultimately, said Lucas, adopting the tones of the radical hippie many supposed him to be, we learned one rule that came out of the 60s, acquire the means of production. It all sounded positively revolutionary, but Carrie Fisher knew better. Skywalker Ranch, observed Fisher drolly, is where George gets to make up the rules. Days before sitting down in his office to begin handwriting his treatment for Episode 1, Lucas had already sent Rick McCallum, his producer from Young Indiana Jones, out to scout locations, billing all travel to the production company Lucas had set up for the new trilogy, J.A.K. Productions, named for his children, Jet, Amanda, and Katie. At the same time, ILM artist Doug Chang was hired to serve as the art director for the prequels, stepping into the role filled by Ralph McQuarrie on the first Star Wars trilogy. Even though I'd just started writing, said Lucas, I already knew certain things that needed to be designed, such as spaceships and planets. Meanwhile, other artists at ILM had been tasked with working on character designs that were still little more than a few brief phrases on the page, with Lucas giving his artists vague descriptions. This character is cowardly and insecure, and letting them take it from there. That included the conceptual design for the amphibious Jar Jar Binks, a character Lucas had high hopes for, who would go through nearly 18 months of design. After more than 20 rewrites and revisions, Lucas would have the first rough draft for Episode 1, at this point called simply The Beginning, completed on January 13, 1995. The script would never be entirely finished. Building off the strategy he'd used on Young Indiana Jones, he would revise the script during filming and even during post-production. But he was comfortable enough with certain elements of the story to ask effects supervisor David Dozeritz and Ben Burt, who was becoming one of Lucas's most deft editors, to cut together a number of low-resolution, roughly animated storyboard sequences called animatics, to guide the computer animators in much the same way Lucas had used his World War II dogfight footage to inspire the visual effects team on the original Star Wars. The only way you can evaluate the effect shots you're going to need is to cut in temporary action scenes, said Lucas. With Episode 1, it was the first time I was able to use computerized animatics to pre-visualize the entire film before I even started shooting. The first sequence Burt and Dozeritz were instructed to assemble, then, was the pod racing scene, the high-tech drag race Lucas envisioned as young Anakin Skywalker's ticket to freedom. Fast cars had always been one of Lucas's favorite means of escape, whether it was the car in THX, John Milner's Deuce Coupe in American Graffiti, or even the Millennium Falcon. It was little surprise that Lucas had included it in the script from the very beginning. While Lucas was keeping the development of Episode 1 a tightly guarded secret, just the knowledge that he was at work on the next film seemed enough to excite Star Wars fans. Part of the reason for doing this is that it's the first question I get asked, said Lucas. I think a lot of people want to see it. That certainly seemed to be the case, to judge by the reemergence of Star Wars in popular culture. On television, the Energizer Bunny could be seen battling Darth Vader in a commercial for batteries, and the revived interest in Star Wars-related merchandise. In August 1995, Lucas re-released the Star Wars trilogy on home video, this time issuing the three films with THX sound and a digitally remastered picture. To Lucas's shock and delight, more than 28 million cassettes were sold, generating a profit to Lucasfilm of more than $100 million. The same year, Hasbro, which had soaked up Kenner years earlier, reactivated its option to produce action figures and issued a new line of Star Wars toys under the imprint The Power of the Force. A manager at FAO Schwartz in New York was surprised to see that there were more adults than children buying the new line of toys, a singularity that made the new figures some of the best-selling toys of the year. Marketing directors everywhere would make a note. Toys weren't just for kids anymore, especially Star Wars toys. In fact, Lucas had shrewdly convened a Star Wars summit at Skywalker Ranch for licensees and international agents, where he briefed them on his plans for the future of the Star Wars franchise. Over the course of 2 days of presentations, Lucas reinforced the need for him to maintain quality control especially in the areas of publishing, where some characters, such as Luke Skywalker, who'd been given a love interest in a fiery smuggler named Mara Jade, were living lives far beyond the ones he had written for them in the original trilogy. At a second summit in April 1995, Lucas, who showed up bleary-eyed, joking that he'd been dragged away from writing the script, tantalized the room by hinting that he was considering directing the first of the three prequels himself. As Lucas continued slowly to ramp up pre-production, by early 1996 he would have his art department putting together storyboards for a film that didn't yet have a workable script. He was becoming more and more convinced that digital technology would help him make Episode 1 both quickly and cheaply. The techniques that we've pioneered in the Young Indiana Jones TV series that we're now using in features are going to be one of the major differences about the way movies are made, Lucas proclaimed. Perhaps the most critical of those techniques involved blurring the line between production and post-production, so new scenes could be added or old scenes could be reshot or restaged, even during the editing process. It's not an assembly line. I don't write first, then design, then shoot. I'm doing everything together, he told a reporter. And because he planned to use the computer to create or fill in most of the sets, Lucas was predicting big savings in the expense of making his films. I don't think it's going to cost much relative to the top end that I would ever make a movie for, he predicted. I would never go above the $50 million range. That wouldn't even be close. When all was said and done, Episode 1 would cost nearly $115 million, and almost all of it would come out of Lucas's own pocket. In the meantime, producer Rick McCallum, who'd spent nearly a year scouting suitable locations and facilities to shoot Lucas's still unfinished script, had found a home base for the production. Briefly, Elstree Studios in London had been considered, though that was mostly for sentimental reasons. Every Star Wars movie had been filmed there from 1976 on. Since the fire sale of the facility in the late 1980s, however, the studio was a shell of its former self, and hardly large enough for a production of the scope Lucas was envisioning, even with many of the sets being built in the computer. Instead, McCallum would find what Lucas needed a little less than 10 miles northwest of Elstree at the Leavesden Aerodrome, a gigantic former Rolls-Royce factory that had recently been converted to film production for the James Bond picture GoldenEye. In the summer of 1996, then, Lucas had McCallum reserve the entire studio, including its 100-acre back lot, for 2.5 years, which would leave the studio at his disposal as needed, until practically the day the film was to be released. Immediately, Lucas dispatched a team from the art department, led by production designer Gavin Bouquet, to begin constructing sets across Leavesden's 9 sound stages. Even at this early date, coordination with ILM was critical, as the art department and construction team had to know exactly what parts of the set to build and what to leave for the computer to construct digitally. Most sets would end up being a hybrid of partially constructed pieces, a platform, a bit of wall, a door, and a table, surrounded by blue or green screen onto which the rest of the set could be superimposed digitally later. Lucas and others would come to refer to this amalgamation of high and low tech as a digital backlot. By December, nearly 60 sets would be scattered across the Leavesden sound stages, taking up about 800,000 square feet of space. As he fielded regular reports from London and continued to revise his script, Lucas found, quite to his surprise, that he was enjoying playing in his Star Wars sandbox again. He was especially intrigued by the nearly infinite possibilities that digital filmmaking put into his hands, and he had one more test subject in mind over which to wave his digital wand before unleashing its full power on Episode 1. A movie so terrible, said Lucas, that every time I saw it, I'd think, oh God, that's so awful, I can't watch this. Star Wars. The original Star Wars was a joke, technically, Lucas insisted. We did a lot of work, but there is nothing that I would like to do more than go back and redo all the special effects, have a little more time. While he didn't intend to go quite so far as to redo all the special effects, he did hope to go back and fix some of the things that have bugged me forever, as he told a reporter. There were things I had to compromise on that weren't the way I really wanted them to be. Lucas had started plotting his digital changes to Star Wars several years earlier at a 1993 meeting with McCallum and a team from ILM led by Dennis Muren. At that time, Lucas had complained most loudly about the Cantina sequence, which he was still unhappy with nearly 20 years later, laying the blame squarely on tight-fisted Fox executives who'd refused his requests for money to finish several creatures. With digital technology at his disposal, he hoped to excise some of the rubber-masked monsters dictated by his minuscule budget and fill the cantina instead with the kinds of exotic creatures he'd envisioned from day one. He also still regretted being unable to include Han Solo's conversation with Jabba the Hutt at Docking Bay 94, and hoped now to incorporate a digital Jabba into the discarded scene. Muren nodded and further suggested that ILM take the opportunity to clean up or even redo some of the other effects shots, making tweaks to a few of the dogfights and inserting better explosions. Lucas okayed those suggestions as well, and then suggested they go even further than that, eagerly proposing they insert new digital footage into both Empire and Jedi. He hoped the alterations could be made quickly enough to release the new edition of the trilogy in time for the 20th anniversary of Star Wars in 1997. It would be more difficult than he hoped, for when the films were removed from storage in 1994, Lucas discovered to his dismay that the negatives had severely deteriorated over the past 15 years. Star Wars in particular was a mess, grubby with dirt, deeply scratched, its colors faded. Lucas groaned. Before any work could be done on new footage, the original negative would need to be restored. It would take ILM more than a year to clean up the negative, often using the computer to digitally fill in scratches and match colors frame by frame. The new digital effects were then integrated into the film, sometimes cut directly into the original negative. We called it an experiment in learning new technology and hoped that the theatrical release would pay for the work we had done, said Lucas. It was basically a way to take this thorn out of my side and have the thing finished the way I originally wanted it to be finished. The effort had cost nearly $5 million for the restoration and a little more than 4.5 minutes of new or reworked material. For many fans of the original Star Wars, it was 4.5 minutes too much. Lucas released Star Wars, the Special Edition, in theaters in January 1997. Special editions of Empire and Jedi would follow in February and March, respectively, to enormous hype and impressive numbers, racking up $35 million in its first 4 days of release. But many fans who had grown up with the movies in their original state were furious with Lucas for tampering with them. In addition to the revised cantina sequence, ILM had digitally added characters and creatures to other scenes, sending more stormtroopers chasing after Han Solo on the Death Star, and inserting droids, Dewbacks, Jawas, and other creatures in the streets of Mos Eisley, with almost too much relish. Such digital clutter was distracting and inconsequential to the story. The same could probably be said for the new sequence with Han and Jabba, which added a bit more backstory to their antagonistic relationship, but ultimately left the two characters unchanged. That wasn't the case, however, with an alteration Lucas saw as little more than a minor tweak, but one that fans would come to regard as an unforgivable reinventing of one of the trilogy's most popular characters. At Lucas's request, ILM had altered the cantina confrontation between Han Solo and the bounty hunter Greedo, which had ended with Han gunning the hapless Greedo down, to instead show Greedo squeezing off a shot first, thus turning Han's previously aggressive blast into what Lucas saw as simply self-defense. Fans were apoplectic. To many, that single shot from Greedo had immediately changed the very nature of Han Solo's character, denying him an evolution from selfish, morally ambiguous pirate to self-sacrificing hero. Han shot first, they insisted, a rallying cry that would soon be emblazoned across t-shirts, stickers, and eventually, much of the internet, as a defiant reminder of the perils of meddling with a mythology. At first, Lucas insisted lamely that Greedo had always shot first, and that muddy editing had made the true nature of the confrontation unclear. What I did was try to clean up the confusion, Lucas explained patiently. It had been done in all close-ups, and it was confusing about who did what to whom. I put a little wider shot in there that made it clear that Greedo is the one who shot first, but everyone wanted to think that Han shot first, because they wanted to think that he actually just gunned him down. And yet this was more of Lucas's retroactive continuity, for his own shooting script for Star Wars, dated May 15, 1976, clearly never gave Greedo a chance to squeeze off a shot. Suddenly, the slimy alien disappears in a blinding flash of light. Han pulls his smoking gun from beneath the table as the other patrons look on in bemused amazement. Han. But it will take a lot more than the likes of you to finish me off. Han gets up and starts out of the cantina, flipping the bartender some coins as he leaves. Sorry for the mess. But Lucas was determined to stick to his long-running narrative that he'd had all of the details of the entire Star Wars saga planned out from the start. Han Solo was going to marry Leia, he insisted. And you look back and say, should he be a cold-blooded killer? Because I was thinking mythologically. Should he be a cowboy? Should he be John Wayne? And I said, yeah, he should be John Wayne. And when you're John Wayne, you don't shoot people first. You let them have the first shot. It's a mythological reality that we hope our society pays attention to. Another good try, but fans weren't buying it, and never would. While Lucas would never regret the alteration and never quite understand the objections, he would also never live it down, deflecting question after question about it for the next 2 decades. The special edition, that's the one I wanted out there, he would state in 2004, throwing up his hands in annoyance. This is the movie I wanted it to be, and I'm sorry you saw half a completed film and fell in love with it. It wasn't just fans who were annoyed, however. Gary Kurtz, who had produced both Star Wars and Empire, argued that the digital changes were probably a wrong philosophy. It's not the way it was in the first place. The way it was in the first place was the way we released it. Lucas dismissed such razzing. As far as he was concerned, as the creator of the art, he and he alone had the right to do with it as he pleased. Though for all his talk, one wonders how he might have reacted to, say, Kurosawa digitally altering even one frame of The Hidden Fortress. Still, he wasn't above acknowledging the controversy to the fans, even wearing a t-shirt reading Han shot first as he directed Revenge of the Sith. Such controversies aside, the special editions had proven to him that he could actually pull off the things that he wanted to pull off. And the generally enthusiastic reception from fans old and new had further shown that audiences were still eager to see Star Wars in the theater. A celebration of the theatrical experience, Lucas called it. He stoked additional excitement that winter by publicly announcing a decision he'd actually made some time earlier. After 20 happy years out of the director's chair, he was going to direct all 3 Star Wars prequels. It wasn't a decision he'd made easily. Lucas didn't necessarily want to direct them, said Ron Howard. And, in fact, Lucas had approached Howard, Spielberg, and Robert Zemeckis about taking the reins of one or more of the prequels, only to receive the same retort from each of them. George, you should do it. I don't think anybody wanted to follow up that act at the time, said Howard. It was an honor, but it would have been too daunting. Still, not everyone was as encouraging. Coppola, who'd seen his own career defined and consumed by The Godfather, believed that Lucas's devotion to Star Wars had sidetracked him from making the small, arty films that were his passion. I think Star Wars, it's a pity, said Coppola. Because George Lucas was a very experimental, crazy guy, and he got lost in this big production and never got out of it. Marsha Lucas likened the decision to focusing on a pea at the bottom of the inverted Lucasfilm pyramid, the seed from which a colossal and choking vine had sprung. For Lucas, though, it was a matter of control. We were going to be attempting new things, and in truth, I didn't quite know how we were going to do them, he said, so I figured I needed to be there at all times. There was also just a touch of fatalism involved as well. It took a long time for me to adjust to Star Wars, confessed Lucas. I finally did, and I'm going back to it. Star Wars is my destiny. Lucas had taken a different approach to the casting for episode 1, handing off much of the work to casting director Robin Gerland, who had spent 2 years compiling lists, collecting photos, meeting with actors and agents, and winnowing the roster of candidates down to a manageable size before handing it off to Lucas. There was still no script to speak of, but most of the actors were willing to meet with Lucas anyway, excited by the idea of appearing in a Star Wars movie. That was certainly the case with Samuel L. Jackson, who had made a very public appeal to Lucas on the British talk show TFI Friday in December 1996, begging to be considered for any role. "I got invited to the ranch to see if I was serious about that," Jackson said later. "I said, yeah, sure. You can make me a stormtrooper if you want, I don't care. As long as I know I'm in the movie, I don't care if anybody else knows or not." Jackson would ultimately be a very visible presence in the role of Jedi Master Mace Windu, a name Lucas salvaged from the opening lines of his 1973 first draft of Journal of the Whills. While Lucas had in the past expressed an aversion to working with name actors, "I don't think George is interested in collaboration with an actor," said Ron Howard. "He's not a kick-it-around guy." He had no such qualms when it came to episode 1. Besides Jackson, Lucas brought in Irish actor Liam Neeson, who'd rocketed to A-list prominence as the star of Steven Spielberg's Oscar-winning Schindler's List, and spent most of his first meeting with Lucas swapping stories about their families. Lucas liked Neeson immediately. He thought he would lend episode 1 the same kind of gravitas that Alec Guinness had brought the original Star Wars, and hired him to anchor the film as the astute Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn. Very briefly, Lucas had considered an even bigger name than Neeson, indulging a phone call from Michael Jackson, who wanted to play the role of Jar Jar Binks in full makeup and prosthetics, rather than as the CGI creation Lucas preferred. Lucas gently refused the superstar, and dancer Ahmed Best, who would eventually land the role, thought he knew why. "My guess is ultimately Michael Jackson would have been bigger than the movie," said Best, "and I don't think Lucas wanted that." Instead, the part went to Best, who would stand in for Jar Jar during filming, wearing a headpiece with the character's eyes so actors could match sightlines, and a costume with bits that resembled gills, so computer animators could mimic the way the light played off him. Lucas also liked the way Best moved and sounded, and permitted Best to endow Binks with a voice, which Best played as a kind of West Indian patois, and a loping, hand-flapping stride, which would be digitized over Best later. "George told me that we were really going out on a limb," said Best. That would be putting it mildly. Principal photography on episode 1, still titled The Beginning, would start on June 26, 1997 at Leavesden. Security was tight. The script, which Lucas hadn't finished until practically the last minute, would remain strictly guarded, and even Lucas would be required to wear a name tag on set, though his would read Yoda. While Lucas hadn't directed in nearly 2 decades, he found it wasn't a hard thing to get back into the familiar rhythms. "As soon as Liam Neeson walked on the set, dressed as a Jedi, I said to myself, 'I guess I'm back,'" said Lucas. It was as if those 20 years had never elapsed. Still, there were some marked differences between 1977 and 1997. In contrast to the year he had spent making the original Star Wars, when he would come in each morning and walk the sets, mapping out camera angles between his fingers and running his hands over still wet paint, in 1997, most of his sets were barren, usually just a platform, a flight of stairs, or a piece of sculpture set against a gigantic blue screen. "We built as little as we could get away with, and then put up blue screens," said producer Rick McCallum. That still didn't stop Lucas from touring all of the production departments each day, picking up and poking at masks, examining costumes, and fiddling with props. For the first time since 1982, a new Yoda puppet had been built, completely redesigned not only to look younger, but also to be much lighter on the arm of Frank Oz, who had complained about the original Yoda being really fucking heavy. There were also several new R2 units that ran much more smoothly and reliably than the malfunctioning droids from the original trilogy. 3PO, a bare-wired skeletal version of himself in Episode 1, would be a life-size rod puppet manipulated by a puppeteer who would later be removed digitally. The reliable Anthony Daniels, however, would continue to provide his voice. There were other things, too, that would never change. Lucas was still as bad with actors as ever. Despite working this time with several big-name actors, Lucas wasn't about to indulge any deep drills into character or ponderous method acting. "It isn't about trying to find the motivation for every moment," he insisted. "I'm not like some directors who will sit for days and analyze what is going on." And it didn't seem to matter to Lucas that digital filmmaking was a new experience, not just for him, but for his actors as well, who were being asked to work with incomplete sets and react to characters that didn't exist. It took about 10 days or 2 weeks before everyone felt really comfortable with the blue screen, recalled McCallum. But even then, Lucas remained unresponsive to the needs of his performers. "Sometimes I say cut," he said with a shrug, "and sometimes I forget." While Lucas had initially intended to shoot the film digitally, the available technology, to his disappointment, wasn't yet advanced enough for him to fill the entire movie in an acceptable widescreen format. Lucas would shoot a few scenes digitally anyway as a kind of test run, recording some sequences on digital high-definition tape, which would then need to be recorded back to film to be shown in theaters. Watching the footage later, Lucas was convinced he would never shoot on film again. Nevertheless, despite his earlier boast that his digital backlot would make it possible to shoot the movie for around $50 million, costs had escalated rapidly throughout pre-production and continued to climb right on through filming. But Lucas, who in the past had begged studio executives for the money he needed to finish a film, vowed not to scrimp when it came to financing his own movie, no matter the cost. Consequently, he was now pouring all of his money down a funnel labeled Episode 1, risking everything, just as he had done with The Empire Strikes Back. When you're making a $100 million movie and it's your money, pretty much all the money you've got, there's a huge risk, said Lucas. Studios can take that risk and then write it off onto something else. I didn't have anything else. I was gambling everything again. Episode 1 was fast becoming the most expensive independent film in history, and it was all being paid for by one person. Lucas surrounded himself with much of the same crew he had used on Young Indiana Jones, from costumers to his director of photography, who were familiar with his working style and knew the kinds of tricks we would be using on this movie. Beyond that, there was a language that had been developed in the course of doing the Star Wars series, said Lucas, and I wanted to continue it on this film, without having to train a whole new group of people. He relied particularly heavily on McCallum, who saw his job as enabling a director to achieve everything that he can. But even McCallum was a subordinate, not a collaborator. The great thing about Rick is that he never says no, said Lucas, and that was part of the problem. Unlike the first trilogy, when Lucas had often been subjected to pushback from Gary Kurtz, Irvin Kershner, Lawrence Kasdan, and Marcia Lucas, who offered differing opinions regarding production, directing, writing, and editing, the prequels would be entirely Lucas's vision without compromise. His control was complete. Not that he could control everything. While they were shooting on location in Tunisia, doubling again for the desert planet of Tatooine, a massive storm blew through the region, destroying most of the crew's carefully constructed sets. It was 1976 all over again, when a rare rainstorm had washed out most of the sets for Star Wars. It was as if the storm had hidden away for 20 years, just waiting to come back, remarked Lucas, who continued filming on what sets remained intact, as the crew, along with military assistance provided by the governor of Tozer, cleaned up and reconstructed everything. Lucas would wrap things up back at Leavesden, completing principal photography on September 30th. He had maintained a brisk pace over the past 3 months, personally overseeing more than 2,500 shots, but now the post-production work was going to continue at an accelerated pace that ILM supervisor Dennis Muren wasn't sure they could maintain. "George wanted us to produce 2,200 shots in a year and a half," said Muren, And you just think, there's no way you can do it. And then he says, as he usually does, well, just think about it. And he walks out. As Murin and his team at ILM began assembling digital effects, Lucas was working with editors Paul Martin Smith, another alumnus of Young Indiana Jones, and Ben Burt on a first cut of the film, laying in the animatics until the corresponding digital effects were complete. Editing was still Lucas's favorite part of the filmmaking process, and now he had complete control over nearly every aspect of the film, from placement of actors and props to the color of draperies or a cloak. Because of the technology we used to edit the film, we were able to manipulate everything in the frame, said Burt. We could immediately interpret what George wanted to see. And as he had done while making Young Indiana Jones, Lucas could immediately note where there might be any holes in the story he could fill, or whether additional pickup footage was required for clarity. Several times, in fact, he would return to Leavesden, where his sets were still in place, to film needed scenes, including a brief sequence in which Anakin says goodbye to Padme's handmaiden, who had disappeared without explanation in the first cut. Over the next 18 months, Lucas, Burt, and Smith would continue to tighten and refine the story, which Lucas would see as still in flux right up until the end. The script is just a rough sketch of what I'm going to do, he explained. And the filming is just gathering the materials, but the editing is how I create the final draft. The rest of the movie was still being processed at ILM. Most Tuesdays, Lucas would drive down to ILM, still working out of the Kerner warehouses at San Rafael, to review the shots that had been completed during the past week. There was more computer programming than model making going on at ILM these days. The sound of circular saws and the smell of glue had largely given away to the hum of servers and occasional whiffs of ozone. While some sequences would utilize both old and new technologies, integrating both digital and model spaceships into a few dogfights, most effects would be entirely digital. Of course, you don't want to fall into the trap of technology driving your vision, warned graphics supervisor John Burton, but Lucas was reveling in the new technology, asking ILM to fill the screen with a dazzling number of spaceships and battle droids. Creating virtual sets and gigantic crowds was becoming old hat to the ILM crew. More and more now, they were being asked to create believable characters who wore believable clothing and carried believable props and weapons. If Lucas thought a character didn't look convincing or moved in an unrealistic way, he'd scrap the shot and ask ILM to try again. Lucas always said that he only directed half of the movie during principal photography, said ILM supervisor John Knoll. The rest he directed afterward, here at ILM. Lucas, however, had more than just his movie to attend to during post-production. There were licensing deals to finalize, and Lucas found that toy companies were falling over themselves to grab a piece of the new Star Wars universe. Both Hasbro and Galoob announced gigantic deals to market toys and action figures, with the companies giving Lucasfilm stock valued at more than $225 million. The Lego Group waded into the licensing waters for the first time, earning the right to produce the enormously popular Star Wars-themed Lego sets that would, by 2012, help make Lego the world's most valuable toy company. There would also be the usual fast food and candy deals, with Episode I Happy Meals, Jar Jar Binks Pez dispensers, and a billion-dollar arrangement to put nearly every major character on Pepsi cans. Distribution was another prize up for grabs. Because Lucasfilm had paid for the movie itself, however, distribution would be largely a matter of bragging rights. Most of the major studios began wooing Lucas. He ain't easy to woo, said one studio executive. He's not easy to get to. The rights eventually went to Fox, which paid $80 million without seeing a single frame of the movie. The deal made sense. After all, Fox had distributed the original trilogy, but Lucas had taken the opportunity to gouge an additional pound of flesh out of the studio, demanding it transfer all remaining rights to the original Star Wars back to Lucasfilm, which already held the rights to Empire and Jedi. And like that, Lucas owned all of Star Wars outright. The circle, as Vader had said, was now complete. Even with Fox on board, Lucas would maintain total control over the promotion and distribution of the film. Any course of action, any decision, would need his approval. Deftly gauging fan excitement and shrewdly utilizing the newly ascendant internet to spread the word, Lucas was dribbling out information in parsimonious thimblefuls on the new StarWars.com website. In September 1998 came the announcement that the official name of the upcoming film was not Shadows of the Empire, as fans had speculated, but rather Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, a title that sent internet chat rooms into frenzies of debate and conjecture. Then, in late November 1998, exactly 6 months to the day before the film's release date, Lucas deftly released a 2-minute, 10-second trailer in only 26 cities, creating, according to the New York Times, a film event that had no precedent. Showings of Meet Joe Black and The Waterboy were suddenly sold out, the tickets scooped up by fans who paid full admission just to catch the trailer for The Phantom Menace, applauded and cheered for 3 minutes, then left as soon as the main feature began. Several days later, the trailer went up on StarWars.com, where it was downloaded more than 10 million times, in an era when fans still relied on agonizingly slow dial-up connections to surf the web. A second trailer went up in March 1999, with eager fans grabbing it up so quickly, there were nearly 340 downloads each second, that the website crashed. Undeterred, enthusiasts dissected each trailer shot by shot, trying to guess at plot elements. Still other devotees reported weeping openly while watching the trailers. Star Wars was coming back, and fans were certain it was going to be better than ever. "What can I say?" said one admirer after watching the trailer. "George Lucas must be a superior form of life." Lucas was feeling good about The Phantom Menace. For the first time ever, he felt he'd been able to make a movie look on screen exactly the way it had looked in his head. Final touches, John Williams' score, Ben Burtt's sound effects, were still going in as late as March 1999, but Lucas felt happy enough about what he was seeing to wrap his arms around ILM supervisor Chrissy England, who'd been with him since the Parkhouse days, and thank her for her hard work. "He gave me a big hug," recalled England, and said, "You really did a great job. I'm really proud of you." Words he had never once spoken to Marcia. Still, in the weeks leading up to the release of The Phantom Menace, Lucas was doing his best to manage expectations. "For every person who loves Episode One, there will be two or three who hate it," he said. "All I can do now is throw it out there in the real world and wait to see what everyone thinks." Still, Steven Spielberg's very public assessment, "Oh my God, your jaw will hang open for a week," had only served to further spike expectations upward, and fans were waiting in line for tickets more than a month in advance. With that swell of anticipation behind it, it was no surprise that The Phantom Menace would premiere to enormous business. Its May 19, 1999 opening day take of $28.5 million broke all records, as did its $132.4 million opening week. By the end of the year, it would make more than $926 million worldwide, most of it going right back into the coffers of Lucasfilm. While success at the box office was probably inevitable, even the most casual of Star Wars fans was going to check this one out, most critics were unimpressed. "The movie is a disappointment, a big one," wrote David Anson in Newsweek. "Lucas's rhythm is off. He doesn't seem to care about building a character." Anson admitted to being impressed with the design and digital effects, a feeling that was shared by Roger Ebert, who hailed The Phantom Menace as a visionary breakthrough. But while fans had initially jumped to the film's defense, this was the Church of Star Wars critics were burning down, they too would eventually concede that Episode One had been underwhelming, with too much backstory and talk about trade and taxes, and that the over-reliance on digital effects, endless scenes of computer-generated talking frogs fighting computer-generated robots, left the film looking sterile and lacking any real heart. Even Ewan McGregor, starring as a younger Obi-Wan, would eventually concede that the film was disappointing and flat. Lucas had gambled and lost badly with the character of Jar Jar Binks. Despite all efforts to make the character a breakout star, he was even on the cover of Rolling Stone beside the headline, Jar Jar Superstar, fans immediately found him annoying rather than endearing. Worse, with Binks's pidgin English and comically lazy demeanor, there were immediate accusations of negative stereotypes and racism. Lucas took a particular beating from Joe Morgenstern in the Wall Street Journal, who called Jar Jar a Rastafarian step-and-fetch-it on platform hooves, crossed annoyingly with Butterfly McQueen. While Lucasfilm spokesperson Lynn Hale would dismiss such accusations as absurd, the charge stung actor Ahmed Best, who had played and voiced Jar Jar and also happened to be African-American. Even though you play characters, you put a lot of your own personality into it. You get emotionally and personally invested in the work that you do. It's your work, and you take pride in it, said Best. So when your work is criticized negatively, you feel a hit. Worse, Lucas had made a tweak to the Star Wars mythos that many would consider as unforgivable as Greedo shooting first. A biological explanation for the Force. To explain Anakin's unique status as the Chosen One who would bring balance to the Force, Lucas had introduced the concept of midichlorians, intelligent microscopic forms that exist symbiotically in the cells of living beings and help tune them in to the power of the Force. It was an ill-advised explanation that drained the Force of its mystery and awe, making it a mere biological attribute like blue eyes. Gary Kurtz, whose own spiritual views had helped shape the concept of the Force two decades earlier, called the idea the destruction of the spiritual center of the Force, turning it into DNA and blood. Kurtz was also quick to note, however, that George has a very clear idea of what he wants, and whether you agree with that or not, he goes about getting that. Lucas's relationship with his audience was changing in the movie's aftermath. The film was a monster hit, but Star Wars true believers were losing faith both in the franchise and in Lucas. And with the rise of the internet, those same fans could make their opinions widely and loudly known in a way that hadn't existed even 15 years earlier, when Jedi had been released to some muted grumblings about Ewoks. While Lucas had cleverly used the internet to co-opt fandom for the promotion of the film, he was unprepared for the way the same technology and the same fans could just as quickly turn on him after the movie was released. While Lucas would always insist that online carping never bothered him, chalking it up to one person typing out their opinion, the sniping and snarking clearly irritated him. A flashback to the studio executives who complained about his movies and demanded they be recut. When fans groused about midichlorians or griped about Anakin building C-3PO, Lucas, unwisely rising to the bait, dismissed them as nitpicky. "I'm sorry if they don't like it," he said with palpable annoyance. "They should go back and see The Matrix or something." Clearly, the criticism had gotten under his skin, to the point where he dreaded doing one more promotion or sitting for one more interview. Eventually, he would abandon the internet altogether. "I want people to like what I do. Everybody wants to be accepted at least by somebody," he insisted. "But we live in a world now where you're forced to become part of this larger corporate entity called the media. Since I'm doing the films myself, I don't have quite that obligation. I'd just as soon let my own films die than have to go out and sell them on a circuit, and I do as little as I have to feel responsible." That sort of apathetic attitude, however, wasn't going to sit well with the licensees who had paid a fortune for the rights to Star Wars merchandise, saturated the market with goods, and expected Lucas to deliver. Hasbro, which paid $650 million for the toy rights to all three prequels, suddenly saw its stock tumble by 25% on countless bins of unsold action figures and spaceships. Privately, Lucasfilm executives conceded that the movie had likely been too aggressively marketed. Did anyone really want a necktie with Qui-Gon Jinn on it? And further admitted to Hasbro and others that the movie did not live up to expectations. By this point, however, Lucas was already looking ahead to Episode 2, and also had his eye on a spectacular vista near the base of San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge. In 1776, the Spanish established a garrison, their northernmost outpost in the Americas, in fact, at the tip of the San Francisco Peninsula, guarding the mouth of San Francisco Bay. By 1822, that fort, in a state of disrepair, passed into Mexican hands, where it remained until 1846, when it was captured by a small group of American soldiers as part of the Bear Flag Revolt. The U.S. Army promptly took over, setting up a permanent post on the site, though maintaining the fort's original Spanish designation, the Presidio. The Army occupied the Presidio for the next 148 years, erecting hospitals and housing until the base was finally shuttered by the Federal Base Reduction and Closure Commission, which deemed the facility no longer of use for military purposes. With the departure of the Army, the Presidio site, 1,500 acres of prime waterfront territory, quite literally in the shadow of the Golden Gate Bridge, was turned over to the administration of the National Park Service in 1994. Maintaining the site under public stewardship, however, would prove expensive. In 1996, then, Congress created a new federal agency, the Presidio Trust, to preserve and maintain the park and, in a directive unique among national parks, work to attract non-federal resources that would eventually support and maintain the park without the need for annual federal funding. The direction came with an ultimatum. If the Presidio failed to become self-sufficient by 2013, it would be sold off as excess property. With that sort of shadow hanging over its head, it was little wonder then that the Presidio Trust was actively seeking bids for private use of the property. Lucas was interested. After more than a decade of trying to bring ILM onto Skywalker Ranch, Lucas had changed his mind and changed his plans. Instead, he'd create a standalone digital arts complex housing ILM, THX, LucasArts, and the main offices of Lucasfilm, and he'd do it in plain sight in the Presidio compound on the site of the decommissioned Letterman Army Medical Center. Or, that at least was the plan. While Lucasfilm was perhaps one of the most widely recognized and most successful companies in the world, as Lucas had learned in his dealings with his Marin County neighbors, not everyone wanted to live or work next door to him or his company. Several years earlier in Modesto, there had even been some objections to a proposed statue in Lucas's honor, with some city officials cloaking their objections behind an argument against the use of city funds to erect a statue honoring anyone, even the town's most famous resident. Money would be raised privately, instead, to erect a sculpture of two teenagers leaning on a 57 Chevy, a tip of the hat both to Lucas's days cruising Modesto's streets and to American graffiti. The dust-up had been minor, but the message was clear. Not everyone loved George Lucas. Lucas had submitted the proposal for his digital complex to the Presidio Trust in 1998, bidding against several local developers, including the powerful Shorenstein Company. Lucasfilm CEO Gordon Radley was lobbying hard for the project, assuring skeptics that this isn't about Star Wars at all, and comparing the proposed site to an artist's commune. While Lucas planned to keep the footprint small and build everything as environmentally sensitive a manner as possible, many locals weren't so sure. "I don't believe the public interest is served by having Lucas as a tenant," argued one critic, though he admitted that it will be nicer to have Lucas than a bunch of venture capitalists. Such objections, however vocal, were in the minority. On June 14, 1999, the Presidio Trust approved Lucas's plans to turn the Letterman site into a digital arts complex. Here, at the base of the Golden Gate Bridge, not far from the warehouse where Lucas and Coppola had established American Zoetrope 40 years earlier, Lucas would construct the rest of his cinematic empire. At last, he said, he would create an organization to make the kind of movies he wanted to make. But first, he had more Star Wars to attend to.